Position number 21877, rule 4.
Jim Cramer, rail 4.
The Scottish troops were retreating, not in a controlled manner, but in dribs and drabs. They must have been a bit panic-stricken because they left half a load of 4.2 mortar rain, on the outskirts of our company position. Wasn't a very good display at all. When we came to check up, nearly 8 or 9 of the young soldiers for the 70th Battalion who joined us had gone to our platoon positions. So I said, where the hell are they gone? They went back with the recruiting soldiers right back to the beachhead. So eventually they were arrested and brought back to the battalion. And in the First World War, I suppose they would have been tied to gun wheels, but here they were busy engaged for the next few weeks in digging shelters for battalion headquarters and ammunition supplies. And I used that situation later when I was running an adolescent tutorial centre when I was teaching in Portsmouth after the war, to explain to these very badly behaved kids that all this braggadocio and boasting and everything and troublemaking, it's all to the fore, but when the chips were down, they didn't want to know. And these particular boys were a great example for that. After some weeks of quite steady casualties, we had to move to a place called Abreville, which had been, this is sometime in July, which had been heavily showered by the guns of the Nelson and Rodney and other heavy armed ships had been shelled because it was an outpost of the German army. And the 12th Battalion Parachute Regiment had gone in to attack it. I was in the advance party, and when I came that evening to Brayville, I was appalled. The place was like a butcher's shop. Piles of dead and wrecked tanks and guns, dead, both British and German, and weapons scattered all over the place. The 12th Battalion had managed to hang on to the village and driven off the enemy, but at an appalling cost, just about a company strength they were by then. Dreadful. I picked up a lovely Schmeisser, which I carried for some time, because the Schmeisser ammunition and the Sten ammunition, 9mm, they said sometimes worked. You could use the ammunition, but you used to get misfired. But it's a beautiful gun, the Schmeisser. The Sten gun was a very cheap imitation of it. But the Sten, as a gun, wasn't bad, but it had a very bad tendency to jam, because it had a very, very fragile and skinny return spring for the magazine platform. As a result, it didn't feed the reins in properly. But the Powers and us were armed predominantly with the Sten, as well as the number 4 rifle, and the Browning 9mm automatic. So we occupied Brayville, cleared up, buried the dead of both sides. Naturally, we looked after our own dead better than the Germans, sadly, but we gradually improved and gave the German dead the respect they deserved, really, as time went on. And from then on, we moved from position to position. We were on the extreme left of the British Army, a lineup, and mainly to protect the bridge over the Orne, the famous Pegasus Bridge. We very rarely saw armour. When we did see an odd tank, we used to clap and cheer them, but usually we had to deal with it. Usually we had to deal with them. Time came. Oh yes, at the Chateaus in Combe, another position we occupied, is real trench warfare. The Germans were about 150 yards, 200 yards away. I'd lost quite a few men in the platoon I was in, and they formed the survivors into a sniper group. And I was in charge of snipers, where we drew these lovely sniper scopes and attached them to rifles. We were excused dawn stand twos and dusk stand twos, because we went out in the early morning during the darkness to occupy positions during the day. They used to come in at night. They used to have to bind Hessian strips around our rifles. But that was a bit, I don't remember having any kills. I remember a near one when I was walking to a copse I thought was out of view, and suddenly I heard a crack above my head and some leaves came down where some German sniper had missed me by about 7 feet above my head. Sniping was quite general there. We were issued with sniper things for you strapped to your boots to sniper things, are made of a kind of right angle with a fork in it, which telephone engineers have to enable them to climb telegraph pole. But I was never much good at that. I never got more than about 2 feet in the air. But some of the lads were quite good. So I was sniping and patrolling and so forth. It's real World War I experience. Until the end of July, beginning of August, when exercise paddle, Operation Paddle, was brought in, the breakout from the bridgehead. We were moved to positions that were occupied by the Germans. I used lorries to take us out there for a change. And then the great day came when exercise paddle started. We pushed through into the German area. Before we leave, we were the recipients on one occasion of the full benefits of a German defensive fire system. The Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry put in a feint attack on the positions in front of us, and the Germans, for some unknown reason, thought that we were the forming up place. And we received the whole benefit of the German defensive fire, which involved more heavy mortars, light artillery, heavy artillery, and these dreadful things we called Stalin's organs, which were the German rockets, and they came down on us. And we were pinned down in our trenches for about 4 or 5 hours. It was very good for promotion, because the very unpopular RSM and the popular Royal Regimental Quartermaster Sergeant were occupying one trench, no different to any other, and they both were affected by shell shock, and the RSM tried to shoot our adjutant. They were evacuated. And it's strange looking back that when people were evacuated through shell shock or battle fatigue or deserting their posts, they disappeared. We never saw or heard from them again, not even in Civvy Street. I often wondered what happened to them. Became the breakout. Off we went along the coastal road. And the system was, because the Germans in front of us were being outflanked on their left, we were forming kind of little left hooks all the time. So as we advanced, the Germans in front of us had to retire because they are being outflanked in turn. So on our left is all the Atlantic Wall fortifications, empty. We didn't dare go in there because they were booby-trapped. One of our lads did and lost his foot. And then, of course, we received the benefit of the huge guns from Le Havre. the other side of the Seine. And they were enormous 16 or 17 inch guns, and it took about 4 or 5 weeks to move them round from firing seaward to firing on the beaches, and then took another few weeks for them to anchor themselves, so they covered the hour approach march. And the craters they created, they were about 20 yards across. They completely wrecked the road. The advantage was you heard the boom so many miles away, and then you heard an ear-splitting explosion just in front of you. And the routine from then on was, we marched along during the day, just a few little rifle shots from the retreating Germans, and then the retreating Germans dug in, waited for us, and then put heavy fire down on us, which stopped us. So we didn't move during the night, except for night patrol. And this went on all the way through to the banks of the Seine. There's only one occasion memorable to me, and that was when I had the honour of leading the whole of the British Army, I thought, on the advance to the Seine, because I was told to see if a particular village, St. Philibert, or Anclesville, were occupied by the enemy. So I took 5 or 6 of the more reliable chaps with me, and off we went on this road, which went through a thick forest. And although I hadn't been scared of the glider flight, or anywhere else for that matter, not openly scared anyway, I was really a bit jumpy here, because you did not know what was in front of you. The vegetation was impenetrable on either side. You didn't know what was inside. And suddenly we saw a path in front of us. So we crawled towards the path, and it was leading towards a kind of Nissen hut, obviously an army one. We were very, very careful about this. We crawled all over the place, pushed the door open gently in case of booby traps, and then we went in. It's completely vacated, empty. And there was a German Africa Corps, a forage cap there, hanging on a nail, and I thought, I wonder. Well, I knew it was Africa Corps because it's very thin material. So with a long stick, I dislodged it. There wasn't an explosion. So I brought that home as a souvenir. On the question of fear, I was saying that we were excited and anticipatory on the trip over by glider. But it was a little bit overdone, really, because the dear old Nicky McGuire, who was quite old to us, he's about 29 or 30, he was a bugler, not a very good one. And he always used to, when we used to say in the last post, we always knew dear old Nicky, because he always quavered on the high note. But he brought his bugle in. He was with us, I don't know why, because he belonged to the headquarter company. But he gave us all the tunes and calls in the glider, which entertained us a bit. As far as the toilet arrangements, a bit primitive. There was a kind of funnel leading to a tube, which led through to a hole in the courser, and that's all you had. If you wanted to go to number 2, that was hard luck. Bags vomit, they were in profusion, but nobody was sick, as far as I remember. To get back to my leading the British Army towards the Seine, we got back onto the road, and we got to the village. A boy came up to us, a boy, a teenager, about 14, 15, on a bike with my schoolboy French. I asked him whether there's any Germans in the area. He said no. And then I wrote a note out for the battalion on my field message book, and tore the pages out and gave it to the boy and told him to cycle down that road and you'll meet the battalion. We made our way into the village. We met by the French forces at the interior, and they brought along 2 very frightened-looking Germans, and and said they'd been found skulking in a house somewhere when the rest of their units were pulled out. They were absolutely scared to death and absolutely shaking. So, you know, I spoke loudly in English and told them to sit by the side of the road while we pushed further into the village. And as an addendum to that, my friend, Ginger Peg, has never forgiven me because when he arrived with his company, I proudly pointed these two Germans out to him, and he had to take them back to the prisoner of war lager. And he never forgave me because one of them had a German Volta pistol in his waistband. I just looked at him. I didn't think he was armed anyway, so I had to do that then, if Ginger Peg was telling the truth. Getting back to the surgeon, that was it, as far as I remember. The French didn't believe we were German because a P-type helmet looked something like the German parachute helmet. We had to tell them we were English. Nous sommes anglais. That's all I remember. I spoke to quite a few Frenchmen there using my school board French, and one or two of them corrected me in some of the things I was saying wrong. And by the time I reached the Seine, I'd got to the ultimate in language speaking of knowing what people were talking about without translating it in my mind and bringing the French out in response. It's a strange situation. We got to the Seine and saw the splashes from the British naval force as they were shelling the piers. We saw no signs of any live Germans about. Their equipment was scattered all over the road on the way along the coastal road. One amusing thing. We'd always been warned about booby traps and the diabolical tricks the Germans used to get up to. But I was in the lead on one occasion, and in front of us, in the ditch, was a drawer from a desk, and on it was a pair of German army boots, the cavalry boots, which are a bit taller than the ordinary German field boot. And we all laughed. I fancy people, you know, being silly enough to fall for that one. It's obviously booby-trapped. And we went by, and I was told later that nearly everybody went by it until it got to the end with two scruffy little individuals who looked after the latrine, picked them up, and there was no explosion on them at all. So they had a lovely pair of German knee boots. I said that it wasn't a booby-trap, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
And on the same subject, I digress. When I went to the early part of the invasion, when I went to have a look at the famous Pegasus Bridge, there'd been many attempts by the Germans by sending mines down the river. Well, the Germans held the start of the River Orne so they could float the mines down. They tried to shut it, they tried to bomb it at night. And on one occasion they sent a frogman down. And people were pointing out this frogman. He's all bloated, of course, nobody wanted to touch him. And I heard that one of our lavatory, you know, Lance Corporal in charge of latrines, you know, the most unsoldierly person you could get, had climbed down, had a look at this frogman, and he had a beautiful diving watch on. Yeah, big thing, like a soup plate. And worth God knows how much that would have been for loot. You know, our American friends would have given a machine gun for that. Yeah, and he exchanged it later for a new pair of army trousers. We've got to the Seine. The population, the French force of the interior, they were reasonably helpful. But when we got to Honfleur, just before We got to the same. My French was called into being because one of the FFI has stolen one of our soldiers' Sten guns. So I had to go to the local FFI headquarters to try and get the things back, which we did. And I was being driven by the Frenchman's old car back to my position. And there was a line of Royal Ulster Rifle soldiers, fully armed, lined up outside a house in one of the roads, one of the side roads. I said, what are they up to? You know, they've found a bloody brothel. You know, bloody great war going on. And some of these boys they hadn't forgotten. And then they were all lined up.
This is Honfleur?
Yeah, Honfleur, yeah. Yeah, Honfleur. Lovely village. We've been back there since. It's a lovely, lovely, the fish food's out of this world there now. But there's a lovely place. Beautiful houses. Hadn't been shelled or anything, which is surprising. Also, Germans didn't do much defending. And I'm surprised there's so many buildings. If you look at these documentaries of the landing, and when you go over there, there's a lot of stuff still standing on the seafront, which they never shelled. Do you remember the documentaries showing the flaps of a landing craft going down and our troops going ashore? And you got these two big houses. You know, you think everything had been flattened, but it hadn't been. But there we are. That's Normandy. We came, but oh, yeah, that's interesting. We were relieved by the Belgian Brigade. Be relieved on the Seine. It's lovely to sleep without having to do patrols and things. And it was about this time I realised the effect that war was having on my habits, because things were getting so dicey at the end, as far as casualties were concerned, that you, at night, at the dusk stand to, you wondered whether you were going to be alive at the dawn stand to. And the dawn stand to, you wondered whether you were going to be alive that night. It's a strange situation, you know, permeates your being. We got back to Aramonche, where the Mulberry Harbour is. And that was an astounding sight. All the piers going out, all the towers and all the block ships all the way round, battleships and merchant ships all round. And the wind was a bit dicey, a bit rough. So we got in this landing barge arrangement to be ferried out to a Liberty ship, which is standing just outside the block ship area. So we got on this platform, marvellous platform, terrific sight it was. Got into this landing barge. It was a bit rough, even in the sheltered bit. Then we got beyond the sheltered bit, it was very rough. And the landing barge was going up and down, and we had to clamber up, with all our equipment, clamber up two or three ladders with wooden steps, rope ladders, wooden steps. And you knew if you fell, you go straight to the bottom with all your equipment, or you'd be squashed by the landing craft. So you used to wait till the landing craft went up, and then you jumped. And then when you got to the top, you get the sailors. They must have loved, because I was so sudden. They were not sudden. They must have loved pulling the sergeant, Sergeant Major. You see two or three of them, you should get hold of your bag, throw you out with a rail back for speed. And then you used to watch the other people. In the end, only two trips were made. And that was the evening then. So the rest of the battalion had to stay behind. And we were at these marvellous food with these kind of plates with receptacles of various items, know, potatoes and meat. It was an American and cooking it was. And they had and sweet was out, you know, for the custard. All receptacles in these dishes, metal dishes. So that was us back to England and training, re-equipping. Now, the cost, the butcher's bill, as I used to say, the First World War. The original strength of the 1st Battalion, the Royal Ulster Rifles on D-Day, was 864 officers and men. During the Normandy campaign, 51 were killed, 34 missing, and 403 wounded or evacuated through illness. That's 488 total casualties out of 864 men. All in all, there were 594 returned from France, including 218 reinforcements who joined during the campaign.
What condition were you in by the time you got back from Normandy?
What condition? What then?
Yes, what condition were you in?
Oh, physically?
And mentally.
Oh, physically, you've never been so fit in all your life. Mentally, very, very upbeat. We were the best. The brigade were the best, the division was the best. And that's been reinforced by several books I've read on the subject of a troops' morale during the Second World War. And apparently the 6th Airborne Division had one of the highest degrees of efficiency in any unit during the war, the 6th.
Which platoon were you in Normandy?
D Company.
But which platoon?
I don't remember. But I've got I'd only joined them. I don't remember which platoon I was in.
When you describe that business of the 70th Battalion men going back with the 51st Division men, about how many of the 70th Battalion boys were there?
I think there are about 20 or 30, maybe. And that brings on to an amazing situation. After the 51st Division had attacks on Honorine and retreated, didn't retire, they retreated, we had a magazine, a 6th Airborne Division magazine, called Pegasus, or Go To It. And in it, the division commander said that he would not countenance the 51st Division being criticised by members of his division. Because the 51st Division was a territorial division in Normandy, in Africa. It had a lot of casualties and picked up a lot of reinforcement of new soldiers. So that when they came out to us, they weren't the battle-hardened division. They were used to the trained men, the seasoned men, were used to the open expanse of desert. Normandy was the worst possibly, the Bocage country, you know, with high hedgerows, very, very small fields, lots of copses and forests and things, and sunken roads. You had to, you know, catchy-catchy monkey business. You couldn't go across open fields, but they did. We would go up the hedgerows because of, you know, what we learned and everything. But they never learned that. And as a result, they got fearful casualties in Normandy. The Airborne Division cemetery at Ranville is full of Scottish regiments. Terrible casualties. They would blunder across the open fields, you see, which was... homemade, what would Germans used to fire on fixed lines, you know, so they were able to fire on approaches during the night time. And they're very, very skillful, the Germans. We were up against their best. We had SS Panzer Division against us most of the time. Kind of hammering away here, so you get that. Of course, that was the hinge upon which everything swung.